Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
The Republican Party's first presidential nominee was John Fremont in 1856. He got there with a lot of help from his wife, Jessie. The town of Fremont, Nebraska, in fact, just 75 miles south of Sioux City, is named for him. Steve Inskeep is the co-host of NPR's Morning Edition, and he's written a new book, Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War, which tracks the celebrity power couple's rise during the 1840s. Steve, during the couple decades your book covers, the antebellum period, what was going on in our country that allowed the Fremont's popularity to rise in this particular period?
Westward expansion was the first thing. Expansion of the United States. At the beginning of this period, the westernmost city of any consequence in the U.S. was St. Louis. And, of course, the state of Iowa didn't exist. In fact, a young John Charles Fremont in about 1841 or so was sent to map the Des Moines River Valley, where there was there were native nations, of course, but there was nothing of white settlement as we would know it today, or very little of that. Westward expansion was happening, and John Charles Fremont attached himself to that story. He made it himself a leading figure in that great national story because he explored the American West. He mapped a lot of the West. He didn't actually discover all that much that was new because many people had traveled the American West before him, but he came back east and not only composed maps, but wrote best-selling accounts of his adventures with his wife, Jessie Benton Fremont, and they became really huge celebrities.
You know, and Jessie's story is almost more exciting than that of John's, privileged daughter of a United States senator from Missouri. How did she decide to launch this fellow of a real modest pedigree into the national hero status and doing something that women had never done before, putting herself at center stage?
Yeah, well, first she fell in love with him, and she saw, I think, also a way that his ambitions matched her own. She was the daughter of a senator, Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri. He was very powerful. He was very ambitious. He was very interested in the westward expansion of the United States to the Pacific coast. He wanted to have more direct trade with Asia. He foresaw the most important economic relationships in the world, which are the ones across the Pacific that we have today. He wanted to do all of that. She wanted to help him. She was a young woman where her gender limited her from getting into politics, from getting into government, but that's where she wanted to be. She wanted to participate. She really wanted to be her father's assistant. He raised her in some ways as a boy. He had her educated the way that a boy would be educated, but at some point he expected her to go off and be a lady. And she couldn't do so much of that stuff anymore. But what she did was marry a man who was destined to assist Senator Benton in this westward expansion. And so she became, in a way, still her father's assistant and also operated through her husband as his secretary, editor, publicist, political advisor, ambassador to presidents and other people. She was a big part of his political life.
And I found it interesting, they weren't together a lot, so where was she when he's out exploring?
That's true. I'm somebody who is required to travel a certain amount for work, and I feel bad about leaving my family, leaving the kids and everything. I feel bad about going away for a week, or sometimes 2 weeks. John Charles Fremont would go out to the West for 6 months, or 14 months, or a couple of years in one case, and leave his wife and children behind in Washington, D.C., which is where they were based. In fact, they were living for years in Senator Benton's house. John C. Fremont was the illegitimate son of an immigrant from Charleston, South Carolina, and other places in the South. He had no money. He was a young Army lieutenant, and he met and married this very elite young woman and just didn't have a lot of money at the beginning of his life, and so they moved in to her parents' house. That's where they lived for years.
Around the same time I read this book, I read Craig Fairman's great new book, Author-in-Chief, about the books presidents wrote, and obviously Fremont never became president.
Oh, yeah.
Fremont never became president, but could these dispatches that Jesse Fremont was helping him write or essentially writing, could those have been considered campaign biographies for his eventual run?
They were definitely designed to promote him. He began writing them, they began writing them, after an expedition in 1842. which is 14 years before he ran for president. Now, I have no evidence that he was thinking then, oh, I'm going to be president someday, and this is going to set me up for that. But I do want you to know that these accounts are brilliantly written. They are beautiful narrative descriptions of his journeys west. And by narrative, I just mean he told the story in order. We began in what is now Kansas City, Missouri, and we started west, and we went up the Kansas River and then turned over to another river and continued on up to South Pass in what is now Wyoming, and on various expeditions, he ended up in Oregon and California. He told the story in order, which made it really quite dramatic, and he restricted himself to things he had observed himself. This is very clever. It's, in a way, good reporting, first-hand observation. His maps would only map areas he had seen himself. He wouldn't rely on the rumors or reports of others or other people's maps. If he hadn't been to an area, that would just be blank on his map. And his storytelling was the very same way. He would describe what he saw in the order that he saw it, which was very effective and made it more reliable, and also had the effect of making John C. Fremont present in every single scene. He's the absolute star of the story. It's not a description of the West. It's a description of his interaction with the West. And so you can see why, when this became a best-selling book, or actually a series of best-selling books, it made him super famous, not just as an author, but as an explorer and as the star of America's westward expansion.
He made some catastrophic decisions, in one particular, you mentioned in Oregon country. What happened with that?
Oh, my goodness. There were a couple of times that he nearly got everybody killed on these expeditions in snowy mountains. There was one that you're referring to in end of 1843, beginning of 1844. He had traveled all the way to Oregon. He was near what's now Vancouver, Washington, and near Portland, Oregon, what's now Portland, Oregon. And it was late fall and getting quite cold, and he's a couple thousand miles away from home, a couple thousand miles away from St. Louis. Nothing, from his perspective, but wilderness and a few trading posts and native nations between those two places. And rather than go back along an established trail, he set off there at the beginning of winter to try to find some new way through the mountains. And his men nearly ran out of food and nearly starved to death before he decided to slash actually westward from what is now Nevada over the Sierra Nevada mountains in the middle of winter, masses and masses of snow, to get to California where they could get some supplies and survive. There was another expedition later in the San Juan Mountains of Colorado where he deliberately attempted a crossing of the most impossible mountains in the middle of winter, and a number of his men starved to death. While other men survived only by eating their comrades in a couple of cases.
I'm chatting with Steve Inskeep about his new book, Imperfect Union, about Jesse and John Fremont. Steve, you live and work in Washington, work for National Public Radio. Where did you physically do your research for this book?
The biggest amount of it was at the Library of Congress, which is here in Washington, and I'm really, really lucky to live here. Anybody who lives near it should check it out sometime, or if you ever get a chance to visit Washington. Unbelievably gorgeous building and an amazing research institution. And you can go in and request the Fremont papers and be holding in your own hand a letter from 1835 that John C. Fremont wrote to a political sponsor asking for help in getting a job, or campaign artifacts, buttons and pamphlets and things like that from the campaign of 1856 when he was the first ever presidential candidate of the Republican Party. It's all right there. And they also have newspaper databases, searchable newspaper databases, where you can go through just thousands and thousands and thousands of 19th century newspapers and see the way that this 19th century couple use the media in a way that feels really, really modern and spread their story across the United States.
You know, Fremont's name appears in several biographies about other people, and then Alan Nevin's biography of Fremont's about 100 years old. So was most of the research about John and Jesse hiding in plain sight?
I think that's a fair way to put it. There is a small chain of scholars who have gathered the key papers. I mean, they're available. You can actually buy several volumes of Fremont papers. I think they might be out of print. They're like, but you can go on Amazon and buy them, or go into a library, if it's a good library, and find them. So their basic papers are there. A handful of scholars over the course of almost a century kind of passed this task on from one to the next to the next. You can supplement that by what you find in various libraries and elsewhere. The stuff is there, but it's not in our face the way that the story of Abraham Lincoln, one of their contemporaries, is in our face all the time. And there are thousands of books, and you can find many of them in any bookstore. The Fremonts are different in that they were amazingly famous in their time, but their star faded in later years, and they're not nearly as well known. They're often mentioned in histories of the American West or mentioned in histories of the Civil War or other big events because they were involved in so many things. But their story has only occasionally been fully told.
There is a certain aspect of unlikability about them, particularly when you write about their bigotry. Were their views on racial relations in line with a lot of Americans back then that it didn't necessarily stand out?
Oh, yeah. I think I'm sad to say we should specify white Americans. Yes, there was a lot of racism in the 19th century. The Fremonts were on the right side of history. Let's give them credit. John C. Fremont was the first presidential candidate, the first nominee of the Republican Party, which was founded as an anti-slavery party. And yet that party did not even call for the abolition of slavery in the United States. That was considered an extreme position that only a relatively few white people had. The abolition of slavery. They said it was okay to leave slavery where it was legal in the American South at that point. They merely wanted to stop the expansion of slavery into new territories because they were morally opposed to it. They believed that slavery was wrong. But a lot of white people in that era believed that slavery was wrong for reasons that had very little to do with the well-being of black people. They were concerned about slavery's effect on white people, that it had a corrupting influence, that it bent American politics, that slave labor was unfair to free white labor, that if slaves were allowed to be moved into the American West, they would crowd out free white settlers who wanted to take the land or create farms or mine for gold in California or what have you. It was a deeply, deeply bigoted, deeply racist time. And it is odd and disturbing, actually, in this modern era to read some of the beliefs that they held. But it's also humbling that even the people who were on the right side of history, who moved America in the direction that it did need to go, didn't always have the right view of everything. And it makes me wonder, in a generation or two, are there going to be beliefs that we hold and things that we do that our children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren will wonder, how could we ever have thought that way? I mean, they may ask, just to raise one possibility, how is it that all of these people understood that climate change was wrong but continued to drive gasoline-powered cars? How did that continue to happen? It is disturbing to read the wrong beliefs of people in earlier generations, but it doesn't make me feel superior to them. It forces me to think a little more deeply about myself.
The third clause of your subtitle, that the Fremonts helped cause the Civil War, this had to do with electoral college math in general. Was this bound to happen no matter who the Republicans nominated that year?
Oh, I don't know exactly. The reason that I say they helped cause the Civil War is because they were important figures in the foundation of the Republican Party. The Republican Party was the first significant major party that opposed slavery in any way whatsoever. And that development of that party reflected the growing political power of the North. It was possible in the 1850s, where it hadn't been before, to elect a president with Northern votes alone, because the North had become way more populous and therefore more powerful. And the Fremonts were part of that. And it's that movement, that anti-slavery movement, that did help to bring on the Civil War, because Southern states said, we're being cut out of power. We don't want any part of this. If this happens, we're going to destroy the system. They threatened to do that in 1856. They beat back the Republicans. James Buchanan, the Democrat, won, and he was much more pro-slavery. But then they were defeated by that same Republican coalition 4 years later when the nominee was Abraham Lincoln, and they did go to war. Could a different candidate in 1856 have caused a different result? I really, really don't know. What I do know is that that 1856 campaign, even though it was a defeat, was historically significant because it paved the way for Lincoln and paved the way for the end of slavery, even though it took a civil war to get to that.
The book is Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. He's Steve Inskeep. He is the author. Steve, just in another amazing book, and I thank you for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. And all the gold.